you might ask why we're getting stuck on this trivial episode about the waters of Cebus. Well, actually, it's very important. It's a very important part of the Book of Mormon, and a very important part of warfare. We should mention, you don't get into the big wars in the Book of Mormon until the next part, till later on. We must mention Carl von Clausewitz. That's a... he's 1783 to 1831. He wrote his great work, two-volume work, which is the Bible of the... for 150 years has been the Bible of the military. Wasn't published until 1833, so Joseph Smith is saved by the bell there. And he couldn't have used it, though the Book of Mormon reads exactly like... as if it had been written by someone who had been a diligent student of Clausewitz. His main thesis, you see, is the same thesis of the Book of Mormon. Begins this way. His most famous dictum is, the second one is about the fog of war. The first is that war is a continuation of politics by other means. That's the way he puts it. War is just a continuation of politics. And what is politics after? It's after power and gain, whether it's the princes or whether it's the industrial barons. They want power and they want gain, and of course they get it that way. He goes into various wars. He was very active in the Napoleonic Wars. And the second rule is that war is absolute. When you've decided to fight, cedit legis, as cedit legis, as the Romans say, forget about the laws. If you're going to follow a civilized discussion, you discuss. But when you decide to kick and scratch and gouge and shoot each other, it's silly to talk about laws, because it's absurd to talk about laws of wars or anything like that. War is absolute. When you're into it, you're into it all the way. You can't just go partly. If you're going to go partly, why don't you continue discussion in that case? No, you throw the rule book aside. It's important with him. He says there are, as in the world of mules, there are no rules for war, for battle. There are no rules, he says. Throw away the book. So what happens? And then what's the object? Third point of Clausewitz. What is the object? It is the total destruction of the other side's capacity to do anything at all. I mean, you have to make them their total submission and so forth. So it's total destruction. So that's what we have in the Book of Mormon. You begin with setting your hearts on riches, and they're already on the high road to destruction. That's what the Book of Mormon tells us again and again. They set their hearts on riches, therefore one thing was going to happen. Well, we get this later in Mormon. See, it builds up climactically as you get those terrible, terrible chapters in Mormon that are so modern and so frightening and so relevant. Well, but now how about this business of at the waters of Cebus? Best to read very quickly here a summary, and then we'll see what it is. This is in the 17th chapter of Alma, as you know. The Lamanites would drive their flocks to a particular watering place. 17:26. When they got there, a certain number of Lamanites who had been with their flocks at the water, it said, stood and scattered the king's flocks. It's a fine thing to do. And this was routine. It's been done many times, you see. The servants of the king scattered and fled many ways. And then they lamented that as a matter of course, quote, now the king will slay us, as he has our brethren, and they began to weep. Well, is everybody crazy here? What insanity is this? The king kills his own servants for losing a contest that had been acted out before. In fact, we're told, 7th verse of the 18th chapter, it was the practice of the Lamanites to stand by the waters of Cebus and scatter the flocks of the people, keeping what they could for themselves, it being a practice of plunder among them. It's like a regular custom. So it was no secret to anyone. This was not an ambush, but something to be expected. But the king's own flocks, how could they get away with that, you see? Didn't he have enough men to protect them if this happened regularly? Well, for one thing, the Lamanites played the game for sport. It was more than meat they were after, for they delighted, we're told, in the destruction of their brethren. And for this cause, they stood to scatter the flocks of the kings. They thought it was great sport. Gaza, as the Arabs have a saying, if we cease Gaza, we'll cease to live. Gaza is a raid. Our word raid is from the Arabic Gaza. They must raid or life isn't worth living if you don't raid. Al-Ghamr al-Ghiza, life is raiding. The fun of it was their main interest. But Ammon spoiled the fun when he stood forth, quoting again, stood forth and began to cast stones at them with his sling. They were outraged. They began to be astonished and angry. He wasn't playing the game fair, you see. So they came at him, after him with clubs. Why only clubs? He had a sword. There's only one way you can yield a club. You can't thrust with it. You have to raise it over your head. You can't cut with it. And thus expose your arms, and with both arms, strongest blow possible. So Ammon took full advantage of the situation, slicing away at the arms raised against him. And yet with his overwhelming advantage, Ammon slew none, save it were only their leader, and he slew him with a sword. He knocked six of them out with his sling and cut off the arms of the others as they raised their clubs, but he only contended with the leader to death. After that, the winning party of the team brought back the trophies to the king, bearing the arms which had been smitten off by the sword of Ammon. 39th verse, 18th chapter. Well, by now it should be clear that we're dealing with a sort of game, a regular practice following certain rules. This comes apparent when a few days later, the very men, quote, who had stood at the waters of Sabus and scattered the flocks, mingled freely and openly with the crowds of Nephites in front of the king's palace. They were the ones that scattered the king's flocks and got the king's followers executed by law, you see. Well, according to the game, they gathered at the palace at a report that strange things were going on. Ammon was causing some stir inside the palace, you see. Some of the people said these things were happening because the king began to regret it. Now, an interesting thing, see, the king saw nothing wrong whatever with killing his servants who lost the flocks, he said. And he stunned later on when it suddenly occurred to him that this might have been a sin. Already people began to say that the king slew his servants who had their flocks scattered, that things were happening because the king slew his servants who had their flocks scattered at the waters of Sebus, unquote. The very men who scattered the king's flocks loudly announced their presence by shouting abuses at Ammon when he came out. They said he had done for what he had done to their brethren at the waters of Sebus. they were there going to get revenge on Ammon right at the king's palace. The brother of the head man, whom Ammon had killed with his sword, drew his own sword on the spot. He had a sword too, you see. And he attacked Ammon. He was going to finish him off on the spot. So the men not only had swords, but only clubs. Isn't that odd? And isn't it odd that the same wicked Lamanites who not only walked around right in front of the king's palace where everybody recognized them, and nobody did anything about it. They're perfectly free to come and go. And no one held it against the winning team that they'd stolen the flocks. They'd stolen them back. No revenge about, nothing wrong with that. The losers were only wrong with Ammon because he had thrown rocks at them and used his sword against men bearing only ceremonial clubs. Why ceremonial? All this reminds us of those many ritual games in which the loser also loses his life, beginning with the Aztec duel, in which one of the contestants was tethered by the ankle, bore only a wooden mace, while his heavily armed opponent wielded a weapon with sharp obsidian edges. Then there were the age-old chariot races of the princes, which one was to be killed by the Taraxippus. The chariot races, the purpose was when you went around the Taraxippus, that's the place where the ghost of the person was buried there, the prince in whose honor this was held. He demanded a human sacrifice, and a chariot had to wreck there. Somebody had to be killed. It was planned that way, you see, that somebody, maybe two or three, there had to be slaughter at the Taraxippus, at the sharp curve. And the equally ancient games at Olympia, it was revenge for the... It was the spirit of, who was it? I remember his name very well. Well, I'll think of it in a second. I always do that, you see. Well, add to these such vicious doings as the Platonista, a game played by the Spartans and so forth, the Crypteia, another Spartan game, the old Norse brain ball, the hanging games of the Celts, the Glima. The Glima was still celebrated down here at Spanish Fork recently. Now, that's a game that has to be played there. It's the ancient game. Well, you see the same game being played in Egypt. The same game is very well drawn in Egypt. The two people are bound together by a belt. You're bound together by a belt. It's rather a loose belt, but each person has a short dagger, grabs the other person's hand by the short dagger, and then they make at it, and one of them has to get killed. Well, what kind of fun is that, you see? That's the glima, but it's the national sport of Iceland. And there are the Philistine games, the duels, David and Goliath and so forth, and the Homeric duels. The point being, you see, this is not to increase slaughter, but to place a limit on it. so that when the hero is killed, then the war is over. Everybody else doesn't have to die. It makes it sacrifices a few for the whole nation, you see. The whole thing, kings that must die for the people. Marie Renault wrote a very good novel on that particular subject, The Kings That Die. That's the idea of the Pharmacus, of the scapegoat. He goes out and perishes. One person dies for all of them. And then at Easter time, of course, it's Barabbas, and one person is released. The kings must die for the people, one who dies for the others. But that saves all the rest of them. So they have these rules. And in the just, when a certain number is slain, sometimes it would be equal numbers on equal side. But when a certain number was fought, that was it. They'd call it off. As I say, wild animals and savages do fight, but they know when to stop. They don't want to exterminate each other. Where the person's... This is one thing where Clausewitz goes wrong. He says it's unthinkable, of course, that there'd ever be a war in which you could find complete extermination. But there the Book of Mormon takes us right through, you see. Nephites and Lamanites, Shias and Coriantum are both sides complete, and now with both sides with nukes, there's no doubt at all about it. And the Minotaur, for example. The Minotaur required the sacrifice of 7 youths and maidens once a year to go in the bull ring, but those who escaped, escaped. But there had to be a certain number, and that was it, you see. But that was all. You stopped at that number. And bullfights today, blood has to be shed in a bullfight, or it's not an official bullfight. Remember, it's a sacral, it's a ceremonial thing, with all the tootling of the trumpets and all the bowing and all the formalities and so forth. But this obligatory bloodshed, to limit it, see, it is so that everybody won't have to go through with it. There is the group and so forth. And so, well, the closest known to these, of course, are namely the bloody fun of the basketball games played at the great ball courts of ceremonial complexes of Mesoamerica. Anyone who's been there, and a lot of you have, I'm sure, have visited the ball courts, the big basketball courts there. These games, either the captain of the losing team or the whole team lost their heads. Everybody didn't get killed. One or two people did, sometimes the team, sometimes just the captain. But somebody got bumped off. Well, you say, why do they do those things? Well, it's better than the way we do it when we go out and clean out everybody, civilians and everybody else. Surviving to the present century among the Pueblos was the race of the coyote and the swallow. They'd have the race across the finish toward the mesa, and the one who arrived first killed the other as he crossed the finishing line, and so forth. Equally horrendous was the yaya, or wawa rite, of the Hopis, and some of the other Pueblos, but the Hopis had... Yes, it's still celebrated in Guatemala. A tall pole, you know, and you swing around it. It's a spring equinox, equal. You swing around it. Head down, they swing around it and swing around it. Well, when the Hopis did it, the pole up until 1900, the pole protruded over the edge of the drop was 300 or 400 feet there, and the pole was cut halfway through. And it was supposed to break, the lucky one, you see. And a human sacrifice was expected. And that satisfied the necessary killing for the year. Well, the purpose of such games was to make a human sacrifice, but as at Olympia and the Roman arena, the religious nature of the thing could be lost in fun and excitement of brutal contest. Granted that the Lamanites at Sebas were depraved barbarians, real yahoos, what's the logical ritual explanation of the way we do it, of course? Tag team wrestling, demolition derbies, laser tag, this sort of thing. Nothing could be more closer psychologically than that, and that has something to do with the bloodshed and so forth. We say here, the games of chivalry were just as rough and deadly as the Sebas sport and far more ancient. Well, what's this getting for? It's a Roman, it's a very important side of psychological warfare and psychology, you see, which the Book of Mormon, I say, it treats all sides of it. And this is the one that applies to our side, too, for reasons that will be presently explained. The game of chivalry was just as rough and deadly as the Sebas sport, far more ancient. Sinua is 1,000 years older than Achilles or David. Monuments from prehistoric Egypt show the first pharaohs bashing the heads of rival rulers with a ceremonial mace, and the famous scenes of the battles of Megiddo and Carchemish display piles of severed hands and arms brought as trophies to the king. That's how you prove that you bring the right arms to the king, you bring them and you pile them up. And so at the battles of Carchemish, King Mosiah, it is Bible stuff too, as well as Babylonian, and the Egyptians were in it too, of Carchemish and Megiddo. The king sits there with big piles of arms in front of him. Well, that's exactly what Ammon brought, piles of arms to show his prowess to King Lamoni. Incidentally, the Egyptian, well, from the days of the Jaredites to the final battle at Cumorah, we find our Book of Mormon warriors observing the correct chivalric rules of battle, enemies agreeing to time and place of the slaughter, chiefs challenging each other to a single combat for the kingdom and so forth. I have written now, see, Clausewitz says you're going to go through those formalities just to fool the guy. You just pretend to stop. You pretend to, just so you can catch him off guard, as Zarahemla tried to catch Moroni off guard. Now, we say it's human nature to fight and enjoy violence. I say animals and savages fight regular, mating, especially at mating seasons. But we learned from nature documents and so forth, they know how to stop. So there's no point in killing everybody. We have maneuvers today. We still do this. At maneuvers, one round in 10 or one round in 50 will have live ammunition in it, see? That will pay the price if anybody's too careless. Or by decimation. When a Roman army, but it still happens in armies, the Roman army, when a unit had been misbehaved and deserved a court-martial and execution, well, you couldn't execute the unit, you'd be weakening your force. What you do, your decimation, that means pick out one every 10, every 10th person, that's decimation, you see. That would pay the price that the whole unit was supposed to pay, or the whole outfit. And duels stopped with the drawing of blood and so forth. The Indian touch sticks. The Indians have a better way. They go around in the battle, and I touch you with a stick, and you're dead. And as far as that goes, it's like it's where they spatter them in maneuvers, where they spatter them with paint to say that you've been hit. And it's common for warriors to rest during the noonday heat. The Crusaders had the European idea. They wanted to go in and the Battle of Morocco there. Wanted to go in Marrakesh. Wanted to go in and slaughter the Muslims, but the Muslims wisely took off for lunch and rested. And in that particular battle, one of St. Louis was in there, they all died of the heat. They all had heavy armor under clothes on. They stood in their horses waiting for the charge of the Muslims. The Muslims stood in the wall and said, what are those crazy people doing? It's lunchtime. And then the heat started to take its toll, and they started dropping one by one. It was a very hot day, and Morocco isn't a cool place, you see, about 120 degrees, you know, when you're sitting there in armor with heavy wool under it, padded armor, and you're sweating. And you sit very stiff, rigidly awaiting the oncoming enemy, and the whole army was wiped out by the heat. Quite a story. Or, of course, we opponents still make it up after a lusty brawl. The first week in Normandy, General Max Taylor invited the commander of the Germans in Carentan. Our objective was to take the town of Carentan, and he put up a very good defense of it. He invited the colonel from Carentan over to tea. And I was supposed to dress up in my bed and tucker and go and invite him to tea, because I spoke German, as he was supposed to invite the general to tea. Changed his mind, thought it'd be better if an officer invited him to tea. So an officer came, but the colonel refused. But after that, Max Taylor was known to all the German generals as De Letzte the gentleman. He was the last gentleman, was Taylor. But while the battle was going on, he wanted to have tea with the colonel over on the other side. Well, so here, we have this aspect now. There is one phrase that's used repeatedly in the Book of Mormon. It's a very disturbing one. Go into that. It's this one. We talk about people who delighted in the shedding of blood. We're repeatedly told, for example, that Moroni did not delight in the shedding of blood. We delight in the shedding of blood today. You see, that's a very bad sign, the Mormon tells us. To say I enjoy the ballet or football doesn't necessarily mean that I enjoy dancing or playing football. I enjoy it as a spectator. And the ancient Romans greatly enjoyed the bloody games of the arena. They delighted in the shedding of blood. It was one of their big things, and so do we. You flip through the TV channels, just experimentally last night, between 10 and 15 minutes before the hour, any evening, and you're bound to come up with two or three murders in progress to get the evening going, you know, setting. And it's the one sure selling item on prime time. You see, the murder has to be there. And do the same thing in the last quarter hour, and then you see the vengeance catching up with the mandatory explosion as the car or the boat or the house or the building disintegrates in a glorious burst of boiling flame and flying debris so that everything has been settled with. So these people seem to have an insatiable appetite for violence. Well, we forgot the car chase. You've got to get that in before the blowing up, of course. Over and over and over and over again, they can't get enough. It's the standard plot. It doesn't have to have any plot anymore. It's just the finishing off the shootout at the end. And, of course, shootout is purely accidental, what gets hit and who doesn't. Of course, naturally, you know, the hero's not going to get hit and so forth. But it's so silly. It goes on and on. But this insatiable desire, it expresses itself, well, now of all things, everybody wants to own a military assault, automatic military assault rifle now, which you need for all sorts of things, of course, and very necessary. And it's not sufficient to have murder, the man notes here. We must see the slashes, the gashes, the gaping mouths, the spurting blood. For the gentler side of life, there's the obligatory couple in bed. Now, this is routine everywhere. It's not just, I once saw it 3 months ago, but you turn it on tonight and this is what you'll see. And all of this, you see, sitting safe and cozy with our popcorn and drinks, it's fun to watch others suffer. You see, this has become a main obsession with the youth of the land. They've been brought, they feel sort of immune to this, as if it wouldn't hurt you. These things weren't really hurting these people. They brought forth this new kind of entertainment, the totally explicit display of unlimited cruelty and pain, careful dismemberment of the human anatomy and howling agony. There's real big fun and money in that sort of thing. Now, when the civilization's gone this far, and quite recently, there's something to worry about. Well, we won't go on to the horrid details here, but let's go on with it. What is the alternative? We're immediately taken to the alternative. What Ammon does, he leads Ammon's people. Complete pacifists as far as they go. We are, so now we're on that chapter. The one about Sabus is the 18th chapter. And then we have, notice they delighted in playing the game and the like. And the king is impressed. He says, sure, this man is more than a great spirit. Now, the word great spirit is going to be repeated many times, and that will turn out to be very significant for us. He does send such punishment upon this people because of their murders. People are beginning to think what they've done is murders. And of course, the people of Ammon, later on, always describe their killing in battle as murders. Yes, why did he go on murdering? Could have been ritual murders and so forth. Now, he goes on. He cannot be slain by the enemies of the king. He was a superman. Was the king so weak? And what about his expertness? Now, I know that this is the great spirit, the king says. The king heard these words on the fourth verse of the 18th chapter now. The king said, I know that this is the great spirit. He has come down at this time to preserve your lives, that I might not slay you as I did your brethren. See, he was about to slay them. He had every intention of putting them to death. And it occurs to him for the first time with rather a shock that it must be wrong to kill the way he'd been doing. In other words, it was an established custom. It was the thing to do. Nobody thought of it as particularly wrong. That I might not slay you as I did your brethren. Now, this is the great spirit of whom our fathers have spoken. There's something required and deliberate about it, as I say. I put these other things in here. Now, this was the tradition of Lamoni. This tradition was about the great spirit. And they supposed that whatsoever they did was right. See, it never occurred to him. They were following their customs and their rights, and of course, the same thing, the Lamanites. And so King Lamoni says, he supposed that whatsoever they did was right. Just occurred to him. And so do we. We suppose whatsoever we do is right. Nevertheless, now he began to fear. He began to have doubts, you see. Lamoni began to fear exceedingly, lest he had done wrong in slaying his servants. Now, it's perfectly clear. He was doing it as a custom, as a required gesture, and lest he had done wrong. And now it suddenly occurs to him it might be wrong to slay his servants. I mean, anyone you'd think it would be crazy who didn't know that was wrong, but he didn't. It was customary. People do these things. For he had slain many of them. It's been sixth verse. It had been the custom all along. Because they scattered the flocks and were slain, and that was the established path. He didn't send an army out to defend the flocks. He just let this go on. It was the custom. And then as it says here, the next verse makes it clear that it was a custom. Seventh verse. It was the practice of the Lamanites to stand by the waters of Sebus to scatter the flocks of the people, to drive them away unto their own land. It was the practice of plunder among them. And we have these practices carried out. And that's what a raid is. It's perfectly legitimate. It's carried right down to the Middle Ages. If you read your Froissart, you see all through there, Froissart, when Douglas is on one side, the right thing for a great lord to do was raid his rival's camp at night, cut the tent poles. When the tent falls down, you cry, a Douglas, and make a splendid exit. And that's considered a thing to boast about. That's an accomplishment. Now you read Froissart all through there, the great 14th century. He was secretary to King James, to King Richard II, and he lived for years in Ireland also. And he led a marvelous story about everything that went on then. And this sort of thing. Not only the Arabs do that, you see, it's a gentleman must raid. That famous letter to the Pope, which is here, Stephen III, when he suggested that the that the Frankish nobles stop plundering each other's lands. They wrote back in amazement. Well, what else is a gentleman to do? Isn't that what we are made to do? Isn't that God's purpose, that we raid each other's land and prove ourselves gentlemen, prove ourselves heroes in defense? It was routine. So we can get used to all sorts of practices. Now, it was the practice, and it says it was the practice. Unto their own land is the practice of plunder. See how many times the word practice is repeated there. Now they said unto him, behold, well, where is he? He says, he is feeding thy horses. Now, this is very important, you see. Feeding the horses. Feeding the king's horses. You never find in the Book of Mormon anybody riding a horse. You never find any horse but the king's horses. You never find in Egypt. Now, after the 18th dynasty, you find lots of pictures with horses in them. The king had horses, you know, the Ten Commandments and all that sort of thing. The kings of the 18th dynasty, because they were Asiatics, they adopted the light chariot. And, of course, we have the chariot of King Tut and so forth. But you never find anybody riding a horse. Never. Now, this riding custom is very set in the world, you see. For example, would you or I go ride a giant water buffalo in Southeast Asia? No, it'd be worth your life. But little 8 and 10-year-old boys do. These little naked kids sit around all day long on these buffaloes and never push them around, lead them all everywhere. Isn't that a strange thing? We don't ride bovines. We don't ride horned creatures. Other people wouldn't dream of riding. Now, I had a very good Arabic friend. I traveled with him a lot. He wasn't Arab. He was a Druze, a very learned mystic Druze, so on and so forth. But he would not ride in a wheeled vehicle. He says when bicycles were introduced into Lebanon, Duma and Zahle, places like that, nobody would ride them. They said, you make the back wheel go, but the devil makes the dulab go. The dulab is the front wheel. Satan makes the front wheel go, but you make the back wheel go. That's all right. So, but isn't it an interesting thing? These people that live in flatlands on the plains and deserts of the Near East never rode wheeled vehicles. The Arabs never, you may think they might help them a great deal. On the other hand, wouldn't you think that these brethren in the Book of Mormon that make their long missionary journeys that go for years all over the country, that they would be riding horses too if the king had a horse? Why aren't they riding horses the way the Indians do later? Well, it's an interesting thing that, as far as this goes. Now, where do we first find horses being used? They're being used in Mesopotamia. We find them 4,000 B.C. Horses and mules, they're pulling these heavy old wagons, but never is any of them ridden. They were not ridden, they were to pull wagons. It's a funny thing, these customs. And so we find it here. It's just the king's horses are mentioned, very special. My friend Woodrow Borah, who is a specialist in Latin American history at Berkeley, we shared an office together, we're very good friends. He made the study of the horse, and he pointed out some very interesting things about the horse in Central America. When the horse first appears in America, it suddenly appears on the plains, suddenly, all of a sudden. And the Indians who ride it are absolute accomplished experts. They ride better than any people on earth. Now, as I say, these customs are extremely conservative. And you, for thousands of years, you ride or you don't ride, or it's a tradition or it isn't. So when white men first see the horses on the plains, they see Indians riding them with consummate skill. The big place for trading horses, you notice, was Santa Fe. The horse trading between Mexico and the United States was started. But the horses were plated not from Mexico up to the plains. They were all traded from the plains down to Mexico, through Santa Fe to the south. The horses didn't come from Mexico, from the Spaniards up this way. They came from the Indians down south. There were plainsmen up there, in other words, that rode and were awfully good roaders and accomplished riders. Says some other things that the horses saw. The big horse market, see, at Santa Fe, was all for getting the horses there from the Midwest and selling them south into Mexico to the Spanish. In Homer, they have the chariots. They're great charioteers, as you know. But nobody rides a horse in Homer. Nobody rides a horse, ever. In David and Goliath, nobody rides a horse. And you find the same thing in the Battle of Marathon, for example. The fellow ran himself to death to go to Athens to to announce the victory at Marathon. Why did he do that? Why didn't you ride a horse? It's a funny thing. People use horses or they don't. They have them or they don't. And they use them in a very specialized ways animals are used, just as we don't ride cows. And yet we use oxen. Oxen were more valuable than horses much in crossing the plains. So he's making the king's horses ready, the horses and chariots. Just the king, for a special occasion, they're used as in Egypt, only for ceremonial occasions, only by the king. Nobody else can. Well, the custom still applies. Only the British royalty can have a coach and four, can have, it's eight white horses, pardon. Only an emperor could have a quadriga, could have four horses in Rome. These riding rules and horse and riding rules are very strict. The Germans eat horses. Excuse me. I eat horses all the time when I was on a mission. Other people wouldn't think of eating horses. And so it goes. Here, notice he's feeding his horses, getting his horses and ready chariots for a ceremony because he's going on a big affair to get to a general conference here. For a great feast appointed the land of Nephi, the father of Lamoni, who was king over the land. Now, of course, that's the great assembly. That is the great feast, which has to be held once a year. The king and everybody must come, or if you don't come, you'll be cut off from the kingdom for 3 years. You receive the king's another touch stick, the king's arrow, the hair ur. If the hair ur touches you, you see, then you must come to the presence of the king as quickly as possible. And you must bring something with you for the feast. No one comes up to the king empty-handed, to the presence of the king. This is universal. I wrote two very long studies about that years ago. And about this war stuff and so forth, I wrote another story, one published in the Western Political Quarterly, called Tenting, Toll, and Taxing, the Chivalric Rights of Waging Duels and Wars for the Land and so forth. You had to see, a tent is a toll. You had to pay toll on another person's land. If you didn't pay toll, you had to fight him. And if he won, you didn't have to pay toll. He had to pay toll to you and so on. So it goes and so on. But tent, toll, and tax are all the same word. Taxing is the right you pay, the privilege you pay to live on the king's land. It's not for the land you're paying, but it's in recognition. It's in submission. If you refuse the coin, which could be just a mere token, you see, then you're in a state of defiance. Then you don't recognize his ownership of the land. That's what the tax is. That's why it's called, tax means touch, you see. It's a touch. You put your shield up. When you come into another person's land, you put up your tent, and then you put your shield in front of it, you see. And if he comes up and taps the shield, then you have to come out and fight him, or get off his land, or pay a tax. If you don't want to fight him, you pay the touch, you pay the tax, and then you don't have to fight him, as far as I know. That's quite a system they had. Well, they have it in the Book of Mormon, too. But these horses is an interesting thing, just the same. And this, the point is, you see, they made a great thing about horses being an anachronism and this, that, and the other. Not necessarily so. The horses come and go. They do in Europe, too. Various types of horses appear. The little Polish horse that appeared and then disappeared entirely. Then the great horses and these enormous horses, these Belgians with the hoofs like kegs that were used by the Crusaders and so forth. They're all sorts of. Then the Arab horses, they're something very special. But, and they never ride them. The Arabs don't ride their horses when they migrate, only for races and displays. I had a special engraved invitation, I think I still have it, from King Hussein's secretary to attend the horse and camel races by the Dead Sea there, way back in 1964. The place is completely destroyed now, there's nothing left of it. And they lead their horses and they carry their horses, but they never would ride them across the desert in the ways. They ride the camels and they lead the horses is a family pet, you see. But for the race, it's a show off. They're short races, they only last a little while. Must be very violent because the horses usually bleed violently from the noses in these races. I don't know why that is. They're hypersensitive, very intelligent, lovable beasts. So this treatment of animals, you don't know these animals, what they must have had in the way of horses. Here are not had. And again, you see, with all these horses in Egypt, though they did have them in the royal establishment, King Solomon had a huge stable, as you know. Haven't found any horse bones. So I don't expect to find too many horse bones here as far as that goes. So anyway, he got the king's horses ready. Mustn't slow down too much here. It came to pass that Ammon made ready the horses and chairs, down the 12th verse here, and he saw that the countenance of the king was changed. The king and one of the king's servants said unto him, Rabbana, which means great king. You think that's Hebrew? It is not Hebrew. Remember where these people came from? They came from, I just have the note I took from the big Aramaic lexicon. I couldn't have let it out because I had it all ready.
Well, question.
Yeah.
When the Nephites and the Lamanites went to battle against each other, did they go by feet? Are you saying?
Yes, they were on their feet. Yeah. Usually they are, yes. Well, that usually happens when you go to battle anyway. It was the Romans that introduced this. Well, of course, the Assyrians also introduced the serious cavalry and so forth. It's Asiatic. The cavalry is Asiatic, as you can see. People like Genghis Khan and so forth, they never got. Well, the Persians, as Xenophon says, the three things required of every Persian youth was to shoot the bow, ride the horse, and speak the truth, you see. And Eustace said a man was considered less a man, he'd come down, he was not human as soon as he got off a horse, you see. Spend your whole life, and then of course there are people in Central Asia, as you know, that do, like the Kingirs, that spend their whole days on horses, never get off. They sleep on them, eat on them, and everything else. In other words, you either do or you don't. But these people had them, but only for rare occasions, just ceremonial beasts. And like lions, and he'd use the same way. Then he called him Rabana, our great king. Now, Jastrow tells us, wouldn't you know, isn't this absolutely perfect? I took a very interesting note on that. Of course, I can remember what it says. But Rabana is not Hebrew, as I say. Rabana means, it's Aramaic. Rabba, it means a great one, a great king, a great leader, a great person, a great wise man. But it means a person of utter preeminence, Rabana, the na ending. Of course, with the na, you mean our Lord, our great one. Rab is great. See, Rab is great, but Rabbanim would be our great one. But actually, in this form, it is the Ishmaelite. Notice these people were Ishmaelites, incidentally, which is important. That's why they didn't use the Hebrew term for great king, which would be Melech. You see, you get Melechs all through the Book of Mormon, kings. Melechs, Malachiah, Mulek, and so forth. But here it's Rabana, which is what the Ishmaelites would say, and we're told these people are descendants of Ishmael in this particular community. So naturally they say Rabana, great king. They're rather removed here. And what should I do for thee, O king? And the king answered him, not for a space of an hour. The king just sat there and stared at him. He was stunned at the sight of him. Could he be the Great Spirit? Because it is true that the Indians all expect this Great Spirit that came down to them, visit them. The Hopis do, the Navajos do, they all do. And the first thing that is it the Pahani? Is it the Pahani? The Pahani is the Great Spirit, and so forth. What is it that you're marveling at so great? Behold, I'm just a man. He said, a man, thy servant. The king doesn't taking that. In the 18th verse, he stares at him and says, who art thou? Art thou that great spirit who knows all things? Now, here's Ammon's big chance, see, to take his advantage as Cortez did. Here, the king's going to believe anything he tells him now, how easily he could have done what we have done with the Indians and tricked him, you know. He could have said, remember their stories, what are some of the stories we know about? Mark Twain writes one, Tom Sawyer Abroad. You have one the man who would be king, remember? They were expecting a great spirit to come, and these rascals, Central India, that's in Kipling's story. There are a number of stories of men who've come among the savages, and because of their supernatural power, whether it's the watch or something, Jules Verne wrote another one, the savages are ready to worship them, so they take advantage of that, and they're waited on hand and foot until their fatal flaw is discovered and so forth. And the same thing here. But Ammon answered him, saying, I am not. I say, here was Ammon's big chance to tell a big fat lie and convert the king and everything else. Nothing doing, he says. Well, then tell me by what power you slew and smote off the arms of my brethren, scattered my flocks. Ammon, being wise yet harmless, you see, he's not going to lie, but now he plays a trick. He says, you're going to get him to say, do you believe everything I'll tell you? Yes, I believe everything you tell you, because he was ready to take it, and thus he was caught with guile. So he says, now I can preach to him and he'll believe me. See? So he begins, believe thou that there is a God. God is an epithet, you see. And he says, I don't know, whatever name he used, it be Allah or El, you see. I do not know what that meaneth. Unfamiliar word. Then Ammon said, believest thou that there is a great spirit? Now that's the epithet they all use, the great spirit. And Ammon said, yea. And he said, yea. And Ammon said, this is God. This is Allah. This is, if I was to ask, do I believe in the great spirit? Yes. Now we're going to have this repeated a numbers of times in the rest of the book here, where the great spirit, which they believed in, is made absolutely identical with the God we believe in. So if an Indian asks me, do you believe in the great spirit? I say, yes, I do believe in the great spirit. And the same thing, I mean, if an Arab asks me, do you believe in Allah? There's no other word. There's no other word you can use for God. So I say, of course I believe in Allah. I think I know more about him than you do. I know more about the great spirit than you do. Do you want to hear more? See, this is all. That's the approach that Ammon is using here. He gets him to say, yes, I believe in the great spirit. He says, well, so do I. Now I'll tell you who he is. See? And he says, this is God. And I wonder whether I should read you something here. It's rather distasteful, but it will illustrate what I have in mind, if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. last year, this is January 17, 1986, a certain man, Ronald Ventris, this is a news item, the president of the Customs Clearinghouse, a Denver-based firm, writes a letter to the Navajo Tribal Council protesting favored treatment in hiring practice of Navajos on the reservation. Well, shouldn't Navajos have a favored position when they're being hired to work in the oil fields on the Navajo reservation? He didn't like that at all, and this is the letter he writes. Given the historical facts, we consider ourselves to be members of the conquering and superior race, and you to be members of the vanquished and inferior race. We hold your land and property to be spoils of war, ours by right of conquest. Through the generosity of our people, you have been given a reservation where you may prance and dance as you please, obeying your kings and worshiping your false gods. Now, I'm wondering, is this man a Latter-day Saint? Because I've heard him talk just like that. His name is Ronald Ventris. So I say he's the president of the custom supplying the oil fields with their equipment, you see. Contacted Monday, Ventris said he had no regrets about the sending of the letter, and there was no outrage or anything else. This is the position we have taken. But this idea that they worship false gods, so they have no rights at all because we worship the only true God. That's not so at all. The Book of Mormon tells us a very different story. And Ammon said, "Do you believe in the Great Spirit?" And he said, "Yes, this is God." And Ammon said unto him, "Believest thou that this Great Spirit, who is God, created all things which are in heaven and earth?" Well, the Indian believed that already, you see, as far as that goes. These are all the basic questions. And who is God who created all things? And he said, "Yea, I believe that he created all things that are in the earth, but I do not know the heavens." Well, who does, you see? This is the cosmological aspect of it. And then Ammon explains to him more. He's going to teach him more about it. The heavens is a place where God dwells and all his holy angels. And King Lamoni, speaking with the innocence of a child, says, "Is it above the earth?" And Ammon said, "Yea, it looketh down upon all the children of men, and he knows all the thoughts and intents of the heart, for by his hand were they all created in the beginning," you see. And most people think this, you see, is a primitive superstition. The angels is a place where God dwells with all his angels in heaven and so forth. We smile at the expression. King Lamoni said, "I believe all these things which thou hast spoken. Art thou sent from God?" He doesn't give him a direct answer. It's very interesting, he says here. He's still careful, you notice, not to give false impression or to take advantage of Lamoni's gullibility. He could have exploited that all along. I say, Lamoni is willing to believe anything he'll tell him, but he wants to tell him only the truth. He could, I say, make great capital out of his gullibility and trustworthiness. So King Lamoni says, "I believe all these things. Art thou sent from God?" And Ammon said unto him, "I am a man," so don't get any ideas that I'm super or angel or anything like that. "I am a man. A man in the beginning was created in the image of God, and I am called by the Holy Spirit." He takes it as far as that. He hasn't talked to God face to face, but he is called by the Holy Spirit to teach these things to this people, that they may be brought to a knowledge of that which is just and true. And then he meets him halfway here. "A portion of that Spirit dwelleth in me. It giveth me knowledge and power according to my faith." As you said before, faith is not the power. It plugs into the power. It gives you access to the power. He says, so he gives me knowledge and power according to my faith, and the desires are which are in God. He gives me power according to my faith. My faith gets me the power, but it is not the power, you see. It amounts to it if it comes to that, doesn't it? And then he talks about, he began with the story of the fall and rehearsed and laid before him the records and the holy scriptures. The project would have been impossible without the scriptures. You follow this through. The time, from the time their father Lehi left Jerusalem to the journeyings of their fathers. And he expounded to them all the records and scriptures from the time they left Jerusalem down to the present time, 38th verse. Now, and the plan of redemption that it was prepared from the foundation of the world. See, he takes the gospel back to the pre-existence. Prepared from the foundation of the world. It calls it the plan, you notice. He also made known concerning the coming of Christ. And he began to cry unto the Lord, O Lord, have mercy, the king began to. And now when he said that, the king fell to earth as if he were dead, and it came to pass, the servants came to him and carried him unto his wife. He lay upon him in bed, if he were dead, and he was in bed for the space of 2 days and two nights. I'm going to hurry now because I have just time to tell you an interesting thing here. 2 days and two nights, and his wife and his sons and his daughters mourned over him, and after the manner of Lamanite, great loss and so forth. Well, in the a work called The Ascension of Isaiah, which was discovered in 1832 in Ethiopian, but not translated. It was not published till 1877. We have the Ascension of Isaiah. The same thing happened. Two events like this happened in the Book of Mormon. But this one, the Ascension of Isaiah, is very interesting. When Somnus, the scribe, he is the scribe of King Hezekiah. It's called the Ascension, the Testament of Hezekiah is the work. It's still lost. It's still being looked for, but this part of it came forth. When Somnus, the scribe, and Asser, the record keeper, like Zoram in the Book of Mormon, you see, they're in the court, heard that the great prophet Isaiah was coming up from Gilgal, that was near Jericho, you see, about 10 miles from Qumran, and with him 40 sons of the prophets, because they were collegiate, and his own son Jashem, they announced his approach to King Hezekiah. When he heard this, King Hezekiah rejoiced exceedingly and went forth to meet the blessed Isaiah, taking him by the hand and conducting him to the royal dwelling, ordering that a chair be brought for him. This reminds us very much of Ammon, you see, visiting King Lamoni here. And the king brought his son Manasseh to be blessed, but Isaiah said he didn't have a blessing because he foresaw the great sin that Manasseh would commit. It was Manasseh who martyred Isaiah, you see. Isaiah told the king, however, that such behavior would profit him nothing since Satan would have his way with Manasseh. Later, and this is Isaiah in this case, later it's the king, but later, while he was sitting on the king's bed conversing, the prophet was overcome by the Spirit, and his conscience was carried away from this world. Consciousness was carried away from this world, so that Somnus, the record keeper, began to say that Isaiah was dead. But when Hezekiah the king came and took him by the hand, he knew that he was not dead, but they thought he had died. And thus he lay upon the bed of the king, and in this state of ecstasia, ecstasia means your spirit having you left your body. Ex is out, and stasia means standing up. So ecstasy is when your spirit leaves your body. In this state of ecstasy for 3 days and three nights. Then his spirit returned to his body. And Isaiah summoned Jashub and his sons and Somna the scribe, the whole court, you see, and Hezekiah the king and all those who stood about, such as were worthy to hear the things which he said to them, which he had seen. To them he delivered an ecstatic discourse of surpassing indescribable, he says, surpassing indescribable marvelous works of God, who is merciful to men, and the glory of the Father and his beloved Son and Spirit, and the ranks of the holy angels standing in their places. Now this is the same sort of thing that happens here. He saw the gospel plan, he was transported to heaven, and saw God and his mercy and so forth. And in the same way, when Isaiah comes to, he's going to say the same thing. And later on when the king and the queen. This happens again, you see, this passing, a very interesting passage here, because it says, he fell down to earth as if he were dead, and it came to pass they carried him into his wife and laid him upon the bed. Well, Isaiah is laid upon the king's bed here, you see. And he lay there as if he were dead for the space of 2 days and two nights. Isaiah was 3 days and three nights, see. And his wife and his sons and all the family were there mourning for him when he rose up again. And then he does light up his mind, and he knew that he was carried. Where does he come? Oh, he is not. It carried on a long time, but what he announces, yes, he comes, he stretched forth his hand to the woman and said, blessed be the name of God, for as sure as thou livest, behold, I have seen my, this is the 13th verse when he finally comes to, 19th chapter, as sure as thou livest, behold, I have seen my Redeemer, and he came, and he shall come forth and be born of a woman, so forth. And he sunk again with joy, and the queen sunk down, being overpowered by the Spirit. And here Isaiah, when he comes to, he says the same thing. Surpassing indescribable marvelous works of God, because he has seen the Father and his beloved Son, and the Spirit and the ranks of the holy angels in their places. So he gets these interesting parallels in the Book of Mormon, with Joseph Smith always getting in just under the wire, see. This was discovered in 1832, just too late. Of course, he wouldn't have read Ethiopian anyway. It wasn't translated until 1877. So we have these stunning parallels all stringing along with the Book of Mormon, which obliged me to take something seriously, and which makes me uncomfortable in some regards. I mean, what position is this putting us in anyway? This is getting awfully close to home, if you ask me.